So this series of talks is on a more technical subject on Buddhist tenets and the two truths. Usually the subject is very, very vast. It'll take a long time. So we're going to do a general introduction and hopefully talk a little bit about the two truths in these different systems. That's what the title had said. Can you hear me okay? Should this be closer? So we'll begin with a little meditation as usual. Because even though this is a philosophical subject, you might think, oh, we just start off immediately with the details and the data, philosophical stuff. From a Buddhist perspective, that kind of study can be very, very beneficial if you undergo it with a proper motivation. Proper motivation means virtuous motivation, good motivation. So you might think, as we mentioned before, you might think, oh, come on, I have a good motivation, George, come on. I'm a good guy or girl or whatever. So I'm not saying that you don't have good intention, but all of us, even the great lamas, they always emphasize at the beginning, the most important thing is to have a very positive motivation. In the monastery, Lama Sopa Rinpoche's monastery in Laodo, have you ever heard in Solokumbu in Nepal, in the mountain regions, not at Kopan, but up in the mountains, every couple of years or every year, depending on the, you know, Rinpoche's schedule and so forth, there would be a group retreat. He would invite local people. They would come. I don't think he had to invite. He just had to announce because he is very revered in that area. They would do a mani retreat, Om Mani Padme Hum, you know, Avalokiteshvara Sadhana. And when the sessions would begin, when Rinpoche came, when the sessions would begin, some people would immediately, as soon as we started, they would start starting reciting mantra. Rinpoche would be on his teaching throne, teaching seat, and would be meditating, motivating for maybe three quarters of the session. And then, you know, at a certain point, he would begin to recite mantra, probably with much more. Even just the recitation of mantra with concentration and understanding of emptiness and so forth than other people. But the main point was that he would spend a lot of time in trying to develop a positive motivation, because that's what gives the general, you know, what's coming in ahead, that gives the general outline of it. It produces, it's kind of like the inertia, the initial motivation. Of course, you can have motivation during the action, whatever it is, whether you're making generosity, doing prostrations, studying, whatever. And your mind might be sometimes virtuous, sometimes might get distracted and go down and so forth. But having made a positive motivation, it covers that entire period of time of the action, sort of like an envelope that determines the general tenor, the general quality of that. So we try to generate a good motivation at the beginning. Sometimes prayers are said, as you know, and sometimes they can evoke some positive emotions, on a, you know, good motivation in us. But sometimes they might just be words. So that's why I generally prefer to do meditation and think of these things slowly. So relax your body, sit comfortably, let go, tell yourself, relax, you know, come on. Relax your shoulders, and then within that, relax your mind, which means to let go of any expectations or any thoughts, any other things that you may have been thinking about before. You can think about them later. And just as though, just like if I were to ask you to listen right now, you might be hearing the air conditioner or something. You don't have to produce a sound to listen to. In the same way, if I were to say to listen to your breathing or watch your breathing, observe it, you don't have to control it. Just observe it with a little bit of discriminating awareness that recognizes and distinguishes between the inhalation and the exhalation and the endpoints. Keep your attention on the endpoints when it's barely moving at all, where the mind might want to wander onto something else. So if you begin and you're a little bit distracted in other thoughts, tighten up your awareness. Observe the breathing more carefully and let go of the other thoughts. once the mind is a little bit calm this way, follow one breath to the top of your head, so it was going through your nostrils, to the crown chakra, to your throat, to your heart chakra. And leave your attention there, in the middle of your chest, where there's more sense of the, you know, where you might, sometimes when you say I, you point to the middle of your chest as though there's something there, the subtle mind that seems to be grasping to the I there. Leave your attention on the mind and let go of your attention to the breathing. That will continue. If you've done this meditation for some days now, try to develop, recall, and develop a remembering consciousness of this sense of the spaciousness of the mind that's based on experience. Like the water of an aquarium within which fish are swimming, the fish, if you look through the aquarium wall, are very obvious. These fish-like thoughts. But the water being transparent is difficult to focus on. Same thing with the clarity of the mind. It's just a much more subtle object than, say, the breathing. You can begin to get an intuition of it by recognizing the thoughts come and go without hindrance within the mind. Mind is though like a clear mirror. Whatever you present to the mind is as though reflected within it. Considering the mind, or the knowing aspect, to be a subject in the sense that it has an object, something that it takes as its domain, the objects being the thoughts, the images that arise within the mind also, states of mind. Turn your attention away from the objective thoughts, images, mental images, to the consciousness that's perceiving them, experiencing them. The subjective mind, the mind itself that is clear in knowing. If you turn your attention away from focusing on the thoughts or the images in your mind, you deprive them of their life energy. They begin to dissipate. They become less obvious, sort of disappearing. They become less frequent, arising less often. The consciousness, the mind, has no color or shape. It's an immaterial phenomena. So if there's a blackness that appears to your mind, just open your eyes a little bit, let some light in. Go back to reminding yourself you're not paying attention to the eye consciousness. It's to the mental consciousness. Let go of the sense of your body. That's appearing to your mind as an image. Occasionally think that, let me turn my attention away from the appearance of the body to the consciousness to which it's appearing. Just as it's the nature of that consciousness which is clear in knowing. Even the sense of I, your own self-identity, may still be there as though an observer separate from the consciousness, recognizing that I also is an appearance, an image to the mind, that there is just the mind cognizing, knowing. We focus on the subjective mind that's like space, clear and knowing. Recognizing this particular perception we're trying to cultivate of the mind is something in the course of many, many lifetimes has rarely been encountered. Certainly animals don't pay attention to this. Pretas, hungry ghosts, hell beings, even the desire realm gods, usually we're oriented outside, looking at things, objects, and focusing on them, or focusing on the objects of our thoughts, rather than the mind that's experiencing, knowing those thoughts. This is a very rare, precious opportunity afforded to us by the fact that we have a human rebirth of leisure and endowments. Leisure in the sense we're free from all the distractions and sufferings that are much grosser than what we're experiencing now. Whatever mental torment we have now or worry, it's insignificant. It pales in comparison to the suffering of being an animal or a hungry ghost, a hell being. So think, I'm going to use this opportunity now that I've attained, I've received, so to speak, due to karma that I've created with great effort in past lives. I'm going to use this to fill this clear light nature of my mind with positive motivation, and then in the ensuing hour and a half, 2 hours, try to follow with attention the material that's going to be presented about the various philosophical schools of Buddhism, with the aim of using that information to heal myself to the point where I can start to not just be whole again, but from a Buddhist point of view, but to develop positive motivation, sort of develop strength, like having healed from some illness of self-grasping and self-cherishing, then to continue on with your exercise routine, to build muscle after you've recovered, to build positive states of mind within this clear light nature of the mind. The negative states can be eliminated, positive states can be produced. I think I'm going to aim with the highest motivation to achieve the state of omniscience, which is the only way that I can really benefit all beings most skillfully, continually, without the need of any kind of effort, mind spontaneously, effortlessly, in the most skillful way, most perfect way, working for the benefit of others. I think I'm going to participate this morning. This is my motivation. I'm going to participate this morning to achieve this state of omniscience eventually, to benefit all living beings, all mother sentient beings. As though we were going on a long trip, whatever individual circumstances arise along the way, the vicissitudes of life, the ups and downs, looking beyond them to our final destination, to enlightenment, is our goal. Leaving that imprint in our mind for future lives. I'm going to listen, participate this morning in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And then slowly relax your body, relax your mind, come back to the present. I mean, you are in the present, but I mean, bring your attention to the present here. So, the people who are coming in late, very quiet, like mice. I don't hear you. You're very, very conscientious. Thank you. When I sat down, when I closed, partially closed my eyes, I didn't see as many people before. So some of you have come in afterwards. So I may have mentioned this before. His Holiness the Dalai Lama uses this example sometime that motivation, we should try to develop this, a motivation. As though we were going on a long journey, and we indeed we're going on a long journey to enlightenment. Whatever life you have right now, there might be, you might feel there are obstacles in your life. For many of us, we have the feeling. We have the feeling. Oh, I can't. I don't have any time to do meditation. I have to, I have to work. Come on, I have to work. I have family obligations, children and husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and I have, I need some downtime, go to the disco or watch TV or something like that. So in the end, we might feel we have very little time to practice the Dharma. But to try to develop, when you do have time, this long-term aim, where I'm going, the final destination is enlightenment. whatever arises along the way. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says like this, taking the bus from where he often resides in India, Dharamsala. There's a bus you can take. I don't know if he's ever taken the bus, but he mentions he's probably heard from others. Take the bus down to Delhi. So along the way, and this has been my experience too, the bus may stop for tea somewhere, like in the middle of the night. You get on the bus at 11, the red eye, they call it, or whatever, you know. It's going to arrive in Delhi the next morning. So, you know, 2 o'clock stops at some tea shop, completely dark, just a few little lights on. The tea maybe is not very good. It's a dirty place, and you might, you know, develop unhappy mind. But just to think, where you're going is to Delhi. You know, it doesn't matter. These little, you know, sometimes you'll go to a bus stop along the way. Very nice. You have some nice experiences. Sometimes not so nice. Very frightening, bad. But doesn't matter. You're going to this final destination. That's very, very useful. Lama Yeshe, my teacher, Lama Yeshe used to say when someone might have a jealous mind of someone else, you know, someone of another tradition or someone else in our community or whatever, just this is sort of unhappy mind for various reasons. Lama would say, "We're all going to the same destination, dear." Yeah. So all sentient beings, we're all going to the same destination. So some sentient beings may be a little further in their evolution than us. There's no need for jealousy. We're going to the same destination as them. Those that are not as advanced as us that we might want to discard or, you know, demean in some way, they're going to that same destination. Who knows? They may have potentials on their mind to make more progress this life than we will make. So this is good to keep in mind. I like to think when I'm driving my car, I can see a certain distance in the future on the road. Then maybe there's a bend, there's some trees. I can't see beyond that. Like that, we can sense a certain... although we can't see with clairvoyance, we can sense a certain inevitability of what's going to happen today, tomorrow, although it might be very, very different than what we imagine. But beyond that, we're not sure. You know, we might lose our job, we might get a new job, we might become a monk or nun, or who knows. So it's like turning the corner, but still we're going to this, whatever happens along the way, we're going to this final destination. That's kind of the bodhisattva impetus in the mind. If someone were to, with that kind of imprint in their mind, were to be born, you know, they might not enunciate these words, but the sense of, you know, all of these worldly pursuits are just temporary habitats, so to speak. I'm aiming for something greater. You might seek out teachers as a youngster, and as you grow older, try to fulfill that wish, you know, to how can I find this final destination, where I'm going, highest destination. So this subject we're going to be talking about, again, like some of the other, like the Lohrig and some of the other subjects that we've been asked to teach, a little bit like, you know, might seem a little dry, like my teacher Geshe Sopa, I told you before, when he would teach some of these subjects, he would say, he would look at us, they're like, now we're going to be chewing dry bones, hard dry bones, you know, not like a juicy piece of tofu or a steak or, you know, something, you know, very easy to chew, but dry bone, you know. You might think, oh, I just want to talk about bodhicitta and say Om Mani Padme Hum and feel joy. this particular subject, the philosophical systems that are called, that one way of calling them is tenets. Do you know the word tenet? How would you define tenet? How would you define the word tenet? The English word. Tenant is what? Like lieutenant? No, that's different. Tenant may be something that we hold, or we might think certain rules. Not sure what you think the word tenant means. Here, from a Buddhist perspective, the Sanskrit word, I think, is siddhanta, not sadhana. You know the word sadhana, you know, the thing that you recite? Siddhanta, and the way that the Tibetans have translated in Tibetan, they call it drupta. Drup means maybe established, and this ta is not like ta that means view, tawa. This is spelled differently, pronounced differently, ta, aspirated t. This means the conclusion a conclusion. So one way of translating tenets, siddhanta, into Tibetan kind of in English ends up as established conclusion. Something that you have established through reasoning and understanding in some philosophical system, and you've reached that conclusion. That's kind of, you know, your system. So in talking about that, I remember when we began studying tenets many, many years ago in Manjushri Institute, although we'd studied earlier, one of the monks at the time was in charge of the advertising for the course, the publicity for the course, and he had found some quotation, and I can't remember, I was trying to find it this morning. The Buddha had said something like this, that to ordinary people, the Buddha teaches certain kinds of teachings, practices, and so forth, but to the scholars, the Buddha taught, you know, he said, I teach tenets, so these philosophical systems, so that you can understand all of the teachings in some context. So in general, we could say that there are Buddhist tenets and non-Buddhist tenets. We're not going to talk much about the non-Buddhist tenets. They'll come up peripherally, you know, by the way, along the way. Generally, in the exposition of Buddhist tenets, when they talk about the non-Buddhist schools of thought, philosophical thoughts, they usually talk about the systems that existed in India at the time of the Buddha. We're not going to talk. You wouldn't find in Buddhist texts a critique of Christian tenets or Muslim tenets, or, you know, but you would find critique of the various Vedic schools that nowadays we think of as somehow, we use the general term Hinduism, right? Hindu or something. Most of these thoughts had their basis in the ancient scriptures of the Vedas, but there were some other exceptions. So generally you could say non-Buddhist Buddhist tenets. Of the Buddhist tenets, if we divide it very grossly, we could say there are the tenets of the Hinayana and the Mahayana. You've heard those terms before, right? Hinayana, some people object to that term because it sounds condescending, the lesser vehicle, but this is actually the terminology the Buddha used. It refers to the philosophical points of view that were the basis for aiming for one's own personal nirvana, to become an arhat, to escape from samsara. The Hinayana. The The Buddha taught also another set of teachings for those that had a more courageous mind, perhaps more intelligent in a certain sense, that had in the faculty, higher faculties of understanding, had more capacity, that he called the Mahayana, the great vehicle. I think I've told this story before, when I was in, I live in North Carolina now in the States, and many years ago I had visited the town near me for a course that I was asked to teach over a weekend. One lady had been assigned the duty of driving me around. You know, she was my ride person. And she had she was a florist, you know, and she had her vehicle was an old Cadillac hearse. Do you know what a hearse is? Is that a term you use here? You carry the dead body in, what do you call it? Not an ambulance, but when you're going to the funeral, maybe many people here are cremated, I don't know. Do they have hearses here, you know? Sometimes they're very nice cars, because out of reverence for the dead. And so she had a Cadillac hearse. It was old, and she used it in the back. Instead of putting bodies, she put the flowers when she was delivering there. So when I came up to this, she was in her Southern American accent. She said, "I call this the Mahayana, the great vehicle." She might have had a small Volkswagen or something that she called the Hinayana. I don't know, the little, you know, the small, the lesser vehicle or something. So a vehicle or yana is something that gets us to a destination. So the Mahayana is called that because it gets us to the great destination of enlightenment. The Hinayana is called that by the Buddha himself because it gets you to the lesser destination of a personal nirvana that eventually, from higher tenets point of view, Mahayana point of view, you will eventually leave that lesser destination and achieve the highest destination. Everyone will eventually achieve Buddhahood according to higher philosophical schools. So, non-Buddhist Buddhist tenets. Of Buddhist tenets, we can divide grossly into Hinayana and Mahayana tenets that are the basis for those practices. And the Hinayana tenets, generally, nowadays, although there are many varieties of schools that came up, philosophical schools in the Hinayana, let's say. And these various schools sometimes were just differentiated by different teachers. They had just slightly different way of explaining things, but they established their system of, you know, how they interpreted Buddha's teachings. Or it might have been a particular community or monastic college that had their own point of view. But generally nowadays we divide into two main Hinayana tenets. Susan, no? No. The lady behind you, I thought you were shaking your head. You might have just been getting a fly out of your ear or something like that. Yeah. So, generally we say there are two Hinayana schools of thought, philosophical schools, two tenets. The Vaibhashika, Vai, like V-A-I, Bhashika, and the Sautrantika. Sautrantika sounds a little bit like the word sutra, which just says S-U. This is S-A-U-T-R. It's a little bit similar. So it's based, it's somehow related etymologically to the word sutra. So the Vaibhashika is considered the lesser, less sophisticated, less correct than the Sautrantika, which is considered slightly more sophisticated than the Vaibhashika. And in the Mahayana schools, of the Mahayana tenets, there again, many, many teachers came and taught, but they generally could also be put into two general tenet systems. The Chitta Mantra, have you heard of the Chitta Mantra? Or another name for Chitta Mantra is Yogacara. Chitta Mantra chitta means mind. We were talking in our lower class, chitta. Mantra is not the word mantra, you know, mantra that you say, Om Mani Padme Hum, or some other mantra. This is matra, M-A-T-R-A. Matra in Sanskrit means only, or mere. So the mind-only school, you could call it, the Chitta Mantra. That's one school of the Mahayana. And the other was considered to be the pinnacle of the Mahayana schools is called the Majjhimaka. Madhya in Sanskrit means middle. In Tibetan they say you know Uma Thurman? Have you heard of Uma Thurman? The actress. She's the daughter of Robert Thurman, the famous Buddhist scholar in America. Robert Thurman was, I think, the first Westerner to be ordained in the Tibetan tradition by the Dalai Lama. Many years. Then he lasted as a monk for, I think, 1 year or something like that, 2 years. One of his wife's revelations, I don't think she wrote a book, but some article, interviews with her, she said that he was too interested in wanting to take drugs or something like that, so he gave back his ordination. Eventually became a very famous scholar. So his daughter, I think is maybe his only daughter, he has a couple of sons, he named Uma. So Uma in Tibetan means the middle way, means Majjhimaka, or the Madhya means the middle. But it also is also the name in Sanskrit. The Tibetan word Uma also mirrors a Sanskrit word. It's the wife of Bhairava, one of the wrathful deities, who is causes havoc in the world, kind of causes our delusions. She, in Sanskrit, she's called Uma. So he gave her, his daughter, this name, kind of bridging these two things. So we have the Chitta Mantra school, the mind only, and the higher Madhyamaka school, the middle way school. In fact, that's one of the hallmarks of the Buddhist teachings. When he talked, he said that he taught the middle way. In a very fundamental way, we might say the Buddha taught the path of moderation between extremes of sensual indulgence. Like when he was first born, he was born as a prince, had all of these pleasures, you know, pleasures of the senses and power and so forth. And he gave that up. He sought teachers, and he spent 6 years in, after deciding that these teachers had no more to teach him, he wanted to find out for himself. He spent 6 years in ascetic practices, the opposite of that sensual indulgences and sensual life that he'd had as a prince. So he became emaciated, lived on just a berry a day for some of that time. So then he settled on a middle way, it said. So very, very, just showing this behavior that the total concern and interest and involvement in indulging the senses, you know, just finding the happiness of this life is not the way. And totally abandoning all concern for your body, your health, you know, nutrition and so forth, and just, you know, trying to push through is also not the final way. It's a little bit like tuning an instrument, it said, that when you tune, I'm not a musician, but I've been told this, when you tune a stringed instrument, you have to start from tight and loosen it a little bit, then tighten and loosen and tighten and loosen until you get the right. Is that right? If you start from loose, you know, you, the string is sort of just, you can't, you have to tighten it up a little too tight first, and then, okay, then loosen a little bit, and oh, I've gone too far, get back to that. Does that sound familiar to you? So like that, maybe the Buddha's first, you know, when his practice going to that extreme of asceticism was like tightening up, and then he realized he had to loosen up a little bit to find the middle way, to find the correct balance. So he'd used that terminology in general. It doesn't mean only, I mean, that physical manifestation of his life, giving up the indulgences and pleasure to that extreme asceticism and then settling on a medium, taking food as medicine, not to indulge your, you know, all the pleasures and not avoiding it completely, thinking that it's, it might, in, you know, pander to your attachment and so forth, finding a middle way. That was meant to mirror this search for truth. We might, through the various philosophical tenets, systems, we might tighten up, going through the various systems, our view of what is real and what is conventional, what is ultimate, what is conventional, and so forth. And settling on the right view, that's what is talked about the middle way. Not holding a view, for instance, that might say that nothing exists. This is all illusion, that nothing exists at all. That might be too tight. Or to sit the other view that might say things really exist. You know, this is kind of what our ordinary worldview is today. Even scientists, you know, there's a real world out here. You know, don't believe those religious people, you know, talking about some, you know, that this is maybe not the ultimate reality. All atoms, this is all there is, atoms and molecules and energy and so forth. And so settling on a middle view, the middle way, Madhyamaka, or the Madhya, the middle, was the aim. So we're narrowing down. We're not going to be talking so much about the non-Buddhist tenets. So of the Buddhist tenets, generally, we talk about the Hinayana tenets, the Mahayana tenets. Of the Hinayana tenets, we're going to mention a bit about the Vaibhashika, the beginning, and the Sautrantika systems. And just introduce that so as you hear more later, leave an imprint in your mind to be able to go further. And some of you have studied this already, so it might be just a little bit of a refresher for you and going into some details. And then of the Mahayana systems of tenets, the Chittamatra, mind-only school, and the Majjhimaka, the middle way school. Okay. So of the, let's say, of the Vaibhashika school had a whole bunch of, like they say, there were 18 different variations. It's kind of like a catch-all for other than Sautrantika, most of the lower schools. I'm not sure in the enumeration. I'll have to check. I think the modern-day Theravada may have been an offshoot of one of these Vaibhashika schools. They're said to be, in various enumerations, they said something like 18 different schools, philosophical schools, slightly different, holding slightly different viewpoints sometimes, you know, what they accepted. They said, no, that's it, you've got it wrong. It's this way. The Buddha said this rather than that, or he meant this when he said that. One of those, I believe, one of the 18 or very aligned to them is the Staiviravada. So today we say Theravada, right? You've heard of Theravada? Thera is the Pali word that means, Thera means an elder. Like, for instance, amongst the monastics, once you've been ordained for 10 years as a bhikshu, or bhikkhu in Pali, you can put the appellation after your name as Thera. You know, like you're an elder. So it gives some gravitas, oh, he's been around for a while. If you've been ordained for 20 years, you're called a Mahatera, great elder. I don't know, I've been ordained for more than 30 years. I don't know, there's a Supra Mahatera or something like that. So, for instance, Venerable Brahm, what's his name? Achan Brahm, right? He's. I think he's also Mahatera or Supra Mahatera. I'm just joking. Is that there's no words beyond Mahatera. He's been ordained a long time also, Westerner. And of course, many Tibetans and Indians and Malaysians and Thai and Burmese have been ordained a long time. So the word you may hear like Theravada, or referring to one of the Theravada monks as a Thera, meaning an elder. But the Sanskrit word is not Thera, it's actually Staivira. You may see that if you read the sutras. The same word, it's just that in Pali things are simplified, right? The TH doesn't, in Thera, doesn't symbolize two consonants. It's one consonant, an aspirated T. Do you know what I mean? If you say the Sanskrit alphabet, ta, ta, there's more aspiration, more breath come out. So that doesn't, in Pali, generally there are not, you don't find juxtaposed two different consonants. Like we talked about before, like the word karma in Sanskrit, where you have an R followed by M, karma, in Pali, it's simplified to kama. They double the M. They don't have two different consonants juxtaposed. So, stai-vira is simplified for some rules in Pali to Thera. That means elder. So, the stai-viravada was either one of the 18 schools or aligned to one of them. Of those 18 schools, that's the only thing that's of the Vaibhashika that seems to be existing today as a living system. So they base the Vaibhashika system was kind of explained in a book called the Mahavaibhasha that was composed in ancient India after the time of the Buddha. And the people who followed that text as a general, it was like their Bible. Not, you know, the sutras, of course, and the Vinaya and the Abhidharma were, the, in a sense, the Bible. But in terms of tenets, the Mahavaibhasha for them was a handbook that gave all of the interpretation of these things. Let me see. Vaibhashika, I'm reading here from a very brief exposition of the four schools. It's always the four schools, the two Hinayana, two Mahayana, from Jeffrey Hopkins' book, Meditation on Emptiness, because most of the other expositions of the tenets, you know, the big books, and going into more detail that we need right now. So he said, Vaibhashika means a follower mainly of the great detailed exposition. That's his translation of the Mahavibhasha. So this is this large text, which is a compendium on knowledge, compendium on the Abhidharma. So, you know, the Buddha taught many, many discourses, said he taught 84,000 gave 84,000 different teachings. You've heard that before, right? To counter 84,000 afflictions or delusions. And of those, 84,000 teachings. Here we're not talking about tenets, we're just talking about the teachings of the Buddha, right? They were divided into what was called the Tripitaka. Have you heard that word? The three baskets. Do you know what the three baskets are? I forgot your name. Tipi. You don't know the three baskets? Do you know? The Vinaya Pitaka. Good start. What? Abhidharma Pitaka. And this, did he tell you? Good, yeah. So, of all the teachings of the Buddha, those that dealt with his discourses on the practice of morality and discipline, which included the rules that the monks had to abide by or the vows of a layperson, but also the intricacies of karma, things that dealt with discipline. It was all of these were collected, and they were said to be, if you were to collect those and as though they were physical, put them somewhere in a basket, like you would carry things, you would carry food and other things in a basket. So that was called the Vinaya Pitaka. At the time of the Buddha, the texts were not written down. Later, when they were written down, you might actually think there would be a container you could put all of those texts in, the Vinaya Pitaka. Mainly dealing with discipline, or of the three higher trainings, mainly dealing with the higher training of morality. Then there was the general teachings that he gave that were called sutras. Generally, we might think of all of the Buddha's discourses as sutras. Kind of the word sutra is kind of means discourse in general sense. But when we talk about the Sutra Pitaka, all of those teachings that the Buddha gave that in general dealt with the higher training of concentration, or we could say meditative states, the higher training of dhyana, right? That people often say concentration is not exactly the word concentration. Usually we use for something else, but it's close enough. Higher training of concentration. All of the sutras that generally dealt with that, all of the discourses were called the Sutra Pitaka. And then all of the teachings that he gave about more deep knowledge, higher knowledge about what was ultimate and what were, you know, the stages of the path and everything, they were called the Abhidharma, the higher dharma, higher knowledge. So this the Vaibhashika was mainly followers of the great detailed exposition, the Mahavaibhasha, which is a compendium. Is a companion on the Abhidharma, on knowledge. How about the Prajnaparamita Sutra? Have you heard of the Prajnaparamita Sutra? So is that a sutra? Is that mainly about concentration? I thought it was more about wisdom. Anyone know? From Mahayana point of view, maybe you would say it's kind of like in the not in the Sutra Pitaka, even though it's called Prajnaparamita Sutra, because there the word sutra is mainly meaning discourse. It's more in the compendium of higher knowledge, perhaps. So this Mahavibhasha, I'm not sure if it still exists. Jeffrey Hobbins is using the present tense here. This text distills the meaning of the seven treatises on Abhidharma. So of the Abhidharma teachings that the Buddha gave in the Theravada, generally There were seven main texts. Did you know that? Did you know that? You have peripheral vision. You're looking in front. When I point to you, you know that I'm pointing at you. How do you do that? Maybe he's Buddha. I don't know. He's of course Buddha would say he's not Buddha. So you don't know what the seven are. Does anyone know? I don't mean the names, but what was the significance? They were seven texts that became renowned after the Buddha's time, that supposedly they themselves were not composed by the Buddha, but they were composed by various of his disciples, like Shariputra and others. From their understanding of the Buddha's various discourses on Abhidharma, higher knowledge, and those seven texts became enshrined as the texts to study if you were studying Abhidharma. Okay, because they sort of supposedly drew upon all the Buddha's discourses on Abhidharma, higher knowledge. So the Sautrantika, the next system up, they don't consider these seven texts to be the words of the Buddha. But the Vaibhashikas considered these seven Abhidharma texts, which is basically their Abhidharma Pitaka, as actually like, that's it, that's the Buddha's, the word of the Buddha, even though they were supposedly composed by various arhats and so forth. From the Sautrantika point of view, some of these beings who composed the texts may not have been arhats. They may have made errors. So these seven texts were not the actual word of the Buddha. So this text of Mahavaibhasha distills the meaning of the seven treatises on Abhidharma, which only the Vaibhashikas accept as spoken by the Buddha. The Sautrantikas, Chittimatras, Majjhimikas, none of the other schools accept these seven texts as being the word of the Buddha, actually spoken by the Buddha. So the word Vaibhashika, follower of the Mahavaibhasha in one sense, also means one who asserts that past, present, and future things, objects, are all instances of vibhesha, or substantial entities. So that's another etymology of this word. They say that things of the past still are substantial entities, even now. And things of the future exist now, even though they haven't been encountered yet, as some kind of substantial entities, which is not accepted by higher philosophical schools. So this just gives a little bit of idea of why they're called Vaibhashikas. They depended upon this text. They generally accepted the seven texts of the Abhidharma Pitaka as actual word of the Buddha, that the others do not. Another particularity of the Vaibhashikas is that they accepted or asserted, you know, of their tenets. So of a philosophical school, you may make certain assertions. You could also translate that word assertion as accept, but in the sense of what they assert. Do you know what to assert something means? To state it, this is how it is. They asserted that the most fundamental, if you break up matter into fundamental smaller and smaller particles, eventually you get into the most smallest particles that themselves were partless. How about fundamental physics today in chemistry or physics? When you break down, is an atom irreducible? Yes? Who said that? Is that Sweet Kim back there? Atoms are irreducible? They don't have protons and neutrons and electrons as parts? Pardon? Oh, they are reducible. Okay, you didn't say they were irreducible. They are reducible. How about protons and neutrons and electrons? You know what I'm talking about? You've heard those terms. You must have had to study. This is Singapore. You guys are the top students in the world for math and science, I think, at least, you know, certain measures. So are they the fundamental particles? Well, even now we know that, or there's theories that say that you can break up protons with energy and so forth into sort of component parts. Even those component parts, what are they called? Some of them, for the leptons, for the electrons and so forth, what do they call them? Quarks. Have you heard of quarks? Not quartz, like quarts of milk, or not quartz, like quartz crystal, spelled a different way. Quark, Q-U-A-R-K. Have you heard of quarks? Some have. Who's heard of quarks, just out of curiosity? Very few people, okay. So some famous physicists in the last 50 years or so have, through mathematics, have hypothesized that the electrons and some other particles themselves were reducible to more fundamental particles. One of the names was, because the system, the theory was that there were three kinds of particles that would make up this system. One famous physicist, Murray Gell-Mann, anyway, it doesn't matter his name, he took a quote from James Joyce's text, Ulysses. Anyone ever read that text, Ulysses? Is it like one of, you did? It's very long. How long did it take you to read? 2 weeks only. Wow, that's pretty good. You didn't have a choice. You had to read it in 2 weeks. It might take years to understand what he was. Anyway, he made a lot of allusions. Somewhere in that text, there was some bar scene when the guy was saying, three quarks for Master Mark. So he was drunk and either he meant three quarts of beer for someone or something, but he said quarks. So this physicist used, because the theory was hypothesizing that we're going to be three kinds of particles that made up the electrons, so he called them quarks. So even now, they're not considered to be partless particles either. They have, you know, some kind of dimension and east side and west side. But the Vaibhashikas hypothesized that there were eventually, when you broke down, you reached certain particles which didn't have any parts. So that would mean they didn't have a north side, a west, you know, a south side, an east side. Not that, you know, if you placed anything here, you could say, oh, there's a side facing you, and there's the opposite side, and there's a side on the left, as though partless particles had no dimensions. They accepted this kind of thing. Higher schools, especially the Sautrantikas, criticized this mercilessly, you know, with all sorts of explanations, saying that this would mean that you couldn't build up anything if the particles had no sides. How could you have two adjacent particles? If you tried to build up, you know, some matter out of particles, how could they be adjacent to one another, because they didn't have any sides? You couldn't say that one side was touching this one and the other side was touching the next one and so forth. But the Vaibhashikas asserted that partless particles, that there were partless particles that aggregate into gross objects. And then of the Vaibhashika, so just getting some general idea about Vaibhashika. So the Vaibhashika had several sub-schools. As I said, there were 18 generally considered to be 18 subschools. One of them was from the region in India called Kashmir. And they were, not unsurprisingly, they were called the Kashmiri Vaibhashika. What the Kashmiri subschool, they asserted that these partless particles do not touch one another, but are held together by space. So they were trying to get around this argument that, you know, that seemed to be some complications if you talk about partless particles. Other Vaibhashikas said that the particles surround each other without any space between them, while others say that they touch each other. In any case, gross objects were formed through the aggregation, you know what that means? The collection, putting together of particles, partless particles, and thus that external objects that we see, objects which are entities external to perceiving consciousness, you know, cups and, you know, my iPad and our body and so forth, things that we see and we hear and smell and taste and so forth, that external objects were said to exist truly. So they said that objects did exist, this aggregation of partless particles, combination, collection of partless particles, making some gross objects, and those gross objects existed in reality. They were true. Okay? They truly existed. Now, those of you who have heard of, studied some of the teachings on emptiness and so forth, you know, when we talk about emptiness, we say the emptiness of true existence, that nothing exists truly. It has a particular meaning in the Majjhimaka school. Here, the way that the Vaibhashikas were using the word truly exists, it may be a little bit different. Generally, if you've studied those higher tenets, generally when we talk about reality, we say there are two truths. You know, what are the two truths, KK? Conventional truths and ultimate truths, or conventional truth in the singular and ultimate truth. Depends on how you look at it, whether you use singular or plural. So, what would ultimate truths from the Majjhimaka point of view would be emptiness of true existence. And these things would be called conventional truths. For the Vaibhashika, ultimate truths had a different meaning. Ultimate truths, or ultimate truth. If you take any object like this cup would not be called an ultimate truth for them. If you broke it up into its particles, if you could break it up into particles such that you could no longer perceive that this was a cup, either physically break it with a hammer, let's say, drop it on the floor, and later you look at the pieces, you may not recognize it as a cup. You would say even if you could realize it was a broken cup, you wouldn't call it a cup any longer, right? Those pieces. If the apprehension of cup or object is destroyed, either through physical means or through your mental inspection, if you could imagine its parts and, you know, the smallest particles, if that was something that lost its identity in analyzing, that was called a conventional truth. It was only true by convention, popular convention. What would an ultimate truth be? It's something that if you investigated it and you would not lose the apprehension of it if you tried to divide it into parts. or physically break it into parts, that would be an ultimate truth. So what, maybe from what I've said before, do you have any idea what an ultimate truth might be for the Vaibhashika? Because the word is used, this is one reason for studying the tenets, systems, because they sometimes use the same words, like ultimate truth, conventional truth, but in saying those words, they were referring to different things. They had different kind of definitions of them. So remember, a moment, okay, Sweet Kim says, no, he doesn't know. So just a moment ago, I mentioned that the Vaibhashika accepted partless particles. So could you break a partless particle into its parts? No, by definition. So partless particles, for them, they're hypothetical partless particles that other philosophical schools did not accept. They said, come on, there's nothing that's partless. You know, even something getting smaller, smaller, smaller always has some, you know, sides to it and so forth, parts. So for the Vaibhashika, partless physical particles were ultimate truths. And they also talked about, when they talk about time, your instance of time, you could break up any, let's say a second, well, say in modern terminology, you can break up a second into, you know, quarter of a second, milliseconds. What is a millisecond? Thousandth of a second, right? A microsecond. Can you measure microseconds? Yeah, even, you know, actually not difficult with the laboratory equipment. You can measure very, very short instance of time. According to Vaibhashika, if you got smaller and smaller instance of time, finally you got to an instant of time that you couldn't divide anymore. Partless moments of time, they accepted. Do we accept that, Western science? I'm not sure. I don't think so. You can always go smaller and smaller. How fast does light travel? Anyone know? KK knows. He's a go-to guy for statistics, you know? Was it? Oh. So I think it's, I can't remember what it was, something like, so I think something like 4 feet per microsecond, 186,000 miles per second. That's pretty fast, right? Can you, when someone turns on a lamp, can you notice that the light gets to the wall a little bit later? No, it's like, so, you know. The light from the sun coming to us is not presently being emitted from the sun. It was emitted, how long ago? I can't remember. 93 million miles, you can calculate yourself, some minutes or longer. Like, for instance, the radio waves from the satellites to go around the moon, you know, when the astronauts are there, or these satellites that are going out to the distant planets, takes sometimes many hours for that radio signals, which are traveling at the speed of light through the vacuum of space, takes sometimes many hours. The one that just went to, what was it called, Ultimate Tula or something? Have you heard about that? That asteroid or planet beyond Pluto. You didn't hear about that? Just in the last couple of weeks, the NASA people have gotten signals. The rocket was sent off a couple of years ago. Finally, has reached way out there. So, the Vaibhashikas accepted partless instance of time, partless particles. They also accepted partless moments of consciousness. Say, for instance, our continuum, our mental continuum, you might say, every instant of, every moment, the next moment of consciousness arises based on the condition of the previous moment. Just like any moment of this cup This cup is an impermanent phenomenon, right? Phenomenon. What's the cause of any one moment of cup? The previous moment of cup. That disintegrates, and the next moment of cup arises, slightly different, but so similar that we, if we're looking at it, or we're holding it, we don't notice that in that subtle impermanence. So if you talk about consciousness, the stream of consciousness also, one moment of consciousness arises from the previous moment of consciousness and gives rise to the next moment of consciousness. Consciousness not turning over, I'm just using my, turning my hand to indicate, you know, the next moment. So the Vaibhashika also, so they accepted partless particles, partless instants of time, and partless moments of consciousness. So the shortest moment of consciousness, like when we talk about trying to develop single-pointed concentration, sometimes supposedly one could begin to notice the shortest instance of time that when the mind is changing, a perception of something was changing from one instant of consciousness to the next. So they said that there were also certain, you divide down the continuum of consciousness and you would reach instants of consciousness that they themselves could not be divided any further, that were partless. An aggregation of these is a continuum of consciousness that perceives its objects, you know, barely, nakedly. And they also believed that consciousness, unlike the higher schools, see the higher schools, their understanding of how consciousness perceived objects was a little bit like our scientific view now. We mentioned in the Lowry class, say, eye consciousness is, when we were asleep, is receded away from the eye. Even you open someone's eye at night and you wave in front of them, they don't see anything, right? The eye consciousness has retreated away from that. And when you start to wake up, the eye consciousness starts to inhabit the eye organ, the eye faculty. And when light from an object goes through the iris, through the fluid to the back of your eye, the retina. I had a scare the other day. I had an eye exam, and the doctor said, you have macular degeneration. You might have to have these injections with a needle into your eyeball every month. And it turns out that Sweekim took me to an eye surgeon the other day who said, it's just normal, your age. So that was a relief. But, you know, we understand that an image of what we see is projected upon our retina, right? Western side. This is very much a sort of Buddhist idea, the higher tenets, and that the eye consciousness that inhabits that faculty, some subtle matter within the retina, the rods and cones of our eye, that it is generated in an image of the object. It doesn't actually touch the object that's out here. Let's say if I see this cup, the eye consciousness is not touching the cup, obviously, right, we would say, but it is generated in an image of that cup that is projected on the retina. Does that make sense? No one lost? For the Vaibhashikas, they had, from higher school point of view, what seems like a more fundamental primitive understanding. They said that in bare perception, direct perception, that these consciousnesses, not just the eye, the others also, they perceive the object nakedly without being generated in the image of the object, as though the eye consciousness somehow contacts the object, almost like not quite clear according to their tenets. Maybe some people had particular, Vaibhashikas had particular views of that. So these are all just giving you a little flavor of some of their views. So for the name of this section on the four tenets was conventional and ultimate truth. So one of the things to center on here to remember about the Vaibhashika, what they considered to be ultimate truths. Do you remember? Which and what were ultimate truths for Vaibhashika? Things, well, you could say that was an example of an ultimate truth, but the meaning of ultimate truth was something that, when either physically or mentally divided, would still, you couldn't destroy the apprehension of it. Unlike conventional truths that if you physically broke or destroyed, broke into parts, or you mentally analyzed into parts, at a certain point you would no longer be perceiving cup, right? Those would be conventional truths. Yes? Could you? I didn't catch.
Would the concept of emptiness be ultimate truth for them then?
So generally, if you look through the Hinayana canon, so the Vaibhashika was part of the Hinayana, right? So what is the Hinayana canon today is generally what we consider to be the Theravada canon. That's the only thing we have. You know what I mean by canon? I don't mean the thing that shoots cannonballs. A canon is a great collection, right? That's supposedly something that's authoritative that we call a canon. I think they use in Christianity also and so forth. So the canonical texts, the Tripitaka of the Theravada, if you go through those, I don't think you find the word shunyata in there, emptiness. You find the word shunya, empty. Maybe the word shunyata comes very few places, but in general, in those discourses where it comes up, it's not referring to what the higher schools mean by emptiness, the emptiness of the self. They, in the Hinayana canon, Theravada canon, the word that is used generally is anatma. Do you know what that means? Huh? Atma means self or soul. I, atma. You've probably heard that before. Like Gandhi, what was Gandhi's title? You know the famous Indian? What do they call him? Mahatma, right? Mahatma. The great being, the great soul. You've heard that word. So it comes in a lot of different contexts. So if you wanted to say no soul or no self, you have to have some negating particle on it. Like in English, we have a lot of negating particles that say, you know, it's like a prefix that means not, you know, or less, like sugarless means no sugar, right? Or payless shoes, there's a place in the same. We have a whole, in English, we have a whole bunch of things, some that come before the word, some that come after. So in Sanskrit, one of the very common, there were several also, negative particles, but one of the most common was just the syllable a. So because atma begins with a, you couldn't put just a before it to say a atma. Then the rule of grammar there was you change the initial a, that's the negating particle, to an. So an atma means no self. Or you could say selfless. Does it make sense? So they didn't talk about the word emptiness when they did talk about it, if the Buddha talked about it in the sutras in the Hinayana canon, it was talking about just very gross, like this, he would say, this temple is empty of monks. There were no monks in the temple. There could be monks in the temple, so that doesn't correspond to the higher school meaning of emptiness. Emptiness in the higher school, the emptiness of monks in here right now, or let's say the emptiness of an elephant in here right now. Is there an elephant in the room? Are one of you an elephant? We don't see an elephant. We talked about this in the other class. The lack of an elephant in this room from the higher tenets' point of view would not be called emptiness, because an elephant could be in this room in theory. Emptiness refers to the lack of something which was never there from the beginning. We thought was there. We thought there was this, let's say, this self, because it appears to our consciousness very vividly, but it was never there from the beginning. So emptiness only refers to that concept, not to what the Buddha mentioned in the Theravada scriptures when he talked about shunya. It's like, oh, the emptiness of monks in this temple. That's not a fully qualified emptiness. That's just a superficial meaning of emptiness. So, where were we? Pardon? So, anatma, yeah. So, anatma. So, interestingly, you've heard of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, right? The Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Mahayana Sutras, discourses, kind of higher knowledge. When the Buddha talked about emptiness, there are different length Prajnaparamita Sutras. One of the shortest is called the Heart Sutra, right? We talked about also the 8,000 verse, 10,000, 8,000 verse, 25,000 verse, 100,000 verse Prajnaparamita Sutras. I think 100,000 may be the longest. And there are other Prajnaparamita Sutras the Buddha taught at various times, talking about the concept of emptiness that was a main subject matter of varying lengths. You know what the shortest one is? Is it the Heart Sutra? You think it's the Heart Sutra? No, behind KK. What's this gentleman saying? What's your name? What? Your name is Couple of what? Oh, you're just coming. I was just asking what your name was. Melvin. So, what's the shortest Prajnaparamita Sutra? Do you know? Couple of pages. So, you'll be surprised. The shortest Prajnaparamita Sutra is called the Prajnaparamita in one letter. Even though the discourse is a sentence or two, it's not a couple of pages, but it says that when asked, the Buddha said, "Ah," because "ah" is negating particle, right? So that just the syllable "ah," or in English, I'm trying to draw. You can't see it. I'm doing it opposite to you. I'm looking at a letter A that indicated negation, because from the higher tenets, not Vaibhashika, from the higher tenets' point of view, emptiness is a negation, a non-affirming negation. We mentioned in one of the other classes. What does that mean? You're negating the existence of some kind of thing, like this particular kind of self that's appearing to your consciousness, while not affirming anything else, not saying that, not implying that something else exists. You're just negating that. Like, say, if I say "not elephant," that doesn't imply horse. It just implies "not elephant." There's no elephant. Doesn't imply cow or cup. Is a cup a non-elephant? Yeah, but saying non-elephant doesn't imply any of those things. So those are that's like a non-affirming negation. Emptiness is a non-affirming negation. So in its most, you know, shortest way to describe, the Buddha said, just the syllable ah, non, like, and in when it, that ah comes before atma, it has, just because of rules of grammar, it had the negating particle when it comes before a of atma becomes an. So anatma means selfless. So in the Hinayana scriptures, mainly is talking about anatma. And it doesn't really talk so much about the selflessness or the anatma of outer objects, whereas the upper tenets do. Like, say, the Majjhimaka does talk about, we use the same terminology, selflessness of persons and selflessness of phenomena in the Majjhimaka. But the Vaibhashika wouldn't use that. Generally, the only way you would talk about the selflessness of the Durian is that it doesn't exist as an object of enjoyment by a self of persons. So in that way, it's selfless, but sort of indirectly. It's not talking about looking at the durian or looking at the cup or looking at the car and so forth and seeing and saying it doesn't have a self-identity, which the upper tenets say. Okay, so here we're getting into some subtle points. Some of you who are just, you know, just want some first take of tenets, you might be confused by some things. Some people may have been dissatisfied with just some superficial, so we're trying to find some balance here. So for the Vaibhashikas, Vaibhashika system, ultimate truths are objects that can bear analysis. This is just reiterating what we said. That means even when reduced, either physically or through the process of analysis, physically you reduce it, break it, or through the process of analysis you're thinking of its parts. Ultimate truths are things that when reduced, either physically or through the process of analysis, they still generate in a perceiver an apprehension of themselves. So we know that if we break this cup with a hammer, although you might know those are the pieces of a cup, you don't perceive cup. It would, you know, if you broke them up into smaller and smaller pieces, you just had a big pile of ceramic dust here, you might not even say it's pieces of cup. You don't know what it is. Oh, someone left a mess here. You don't know. You don't. So that's not an ultimate truth. But the partless particles are. For instance, a clay pot, if broken with a hammer or analyzed into parts, is no longer generates a consciousness that perceives a pot or thinks pot. Right? Therefore, a pot is not an ultimate truth, mug, whatever. However, the matter of the pot is still matter, even down to the finest unbreakable particle, this partless particle. Therefore, objects such as partless particles, partless moments of consciousness, and permanent phenomena are ultimate truths. I left that off before. Permanent phenomena. Generally, there's not all the Vaibhashikas accepted that there were some things that were permanent. You know what permanent means? Not changing moment by moment. In the four seals that we talked about before, what was the first seal? All compounded phenomena are impermanent. All things that arise from causes and compounding or coming together of causes and conditions are impermanent. Some of the Theravada presentations have a different, they say all phenomena are impermanent. That would exclude the existence of permanent phenomena, right? They say all phenomena are suffering, whereas the general Hinayana, not just the slower interpretation, would say all, what kind of phenomena are suffering? contaminated phenomena. Certain phenomena are not contaminated and they are not suffering. But they, the third seal, everyone agrees, all phenomena are empty and selfless. All phenomena. There's no exception. So here it's saying that some that accept permanent phenomena, some of the Vaibhashikas say that it is an ultimate truth too. Why is that? Because for them, permanent phenomena would not be outer objects that you can see. They would be intellectually known objects such as uncompounded space and cessations. You know what cessations are when we talk about true cessation? When you have eliminated from the mind some affliction through meditating on the Four Noble Truths in the Vaibhashika system and the selflessness of the Four Noble Truths, not as objects of use of a self. When you eliminate the delusions through understanding selflessness, they are eliminated in such a way that you've taken them from the root, so they'll never rise again. That's called a true cessation. And there are various true cessations from the time of realizing selflessness on the path of seeing. Sequentially, you meditate on that again and again. You are ceasing more and more of the afflictions over time on the path of meditation until you reach the last moment of the path of meditation, and the next moment you become an arhat, you reach nirvana, and all of the, you reach the ultimate true cessation, which is called nirvana. Nirvana is also, you know, an example of total cessation of all of the afflictions. So generally in there's one famous text written on the Vaibhashika tenets that we study in the monastic system called the Abhidharma Kosha. Have you heard of that? Have you heard? It's great. My peripheral vision, I could barely see him out of the side of my eye, but he knows I'm referring to. So who wrote the Abhidharma Kosha, do you know? Vasubandhu, exactly. Vasubandhu had a brother who was very famous, and we've mentioned several times. Do you know who Vasubandhu's brother was? What? Asanga, right? Asanga is the great saint who went to Tushita heaven and received the five texts from Maitreya. He had done a 12-year meditation to try to see, have contact, actualize Maitreya. 12 years in different episodes, 3 years, I can't remember how it was divided. Every time he'd come out, discussed it, he hadn't, and something would impel him. He'd see some vision that would impel him to go back into meditation. It's said that in his 12 years of meditation, he never had a good dream. I mentioned that. Also, in my 3-year retreat, I didn't have a good dream. So I felt, at least, even though that's a negative sign, I felt some allegiance with the Sangha who had these, you know, eventually had some good results. So a Sangha was one of the sons born to this one Indian lady, and she had made prayers that even though she, that lifetime, couldn't help to revive the Buddha's teachings. This was about 600 years, I think maybe something like that, after the Buddha. Even though she herself, her circumstances and such were not such that she could help to revive Buddhism in India, she made prayers that her sons would. So she had sons by different husbands. One of the sons was Asanga, who became a proponent of the Mahayana. One of the sons was Vasubandhu. And Vasubandhu, at first, was mainly practicing the Hinayana. And he disparaged the Mahayana. He disparaged his brother, Asanga. Asanga is talking about the Mahayana, talking about all these things that are not existent, like a sky flower. Do you know what a sky flower is? It's an example in some of the scriptures. It's something that doesn't exist. What's the sky flower? Do you know? Yeah, right. Yeah, come on, George. A scour flower in the sky. What is it? Exist? Well, the implication is it's just there. It doesn't have any roots going into the ground. It's not something that's temporarily in the sky that you threw up and then you take a photograph and it looks like it's just there in the sky. It's like just some flower that's there in the sky. There's no such thing. Although the clouds might look like that, or you might think there's something like that, right? A famous example. So he criticized his brother Asanga as following the Mahayana, which had all these precepts or these assertions or these tenets that were like sky flowers. They didn't exist. He was a proponent of the Hinayana. Later, in listening to his brother Asanga recite the Mahayana Sutras, every year Asanga would take a certain time to recite all of the Mahayana Sutras. I don't know how long it took him, many, many days, weeks. And in that time, he would often get lung disease. Have you heard lung? The sort of like depression, just for some concentrating and memorizing. Sometimes you can get this wind disease from the prana or chi being concentrated. So Asanga would bathe in a bathtub of, I think, sesame oil. You know, oil supposedly helps to overcome, if you ever have lung, it's supposed to be something that helps. So during that time when Asanga was reciting the Mahayana Sutras, Vasubandhu was listening, you know, and he said, wow, this makes sense. So he had a complete reversal of his previous position criticizing the Mahayana, and actually wrote text in the later part of his life, many great treatises on the Mahayana, especially in the Chittamatra school. Remember the two Mahayana schools, the Chittamatra and the Majjhimaka? His brother Asanga wrote mainly about the Chittamatra, the Chittamatra school also, yeah. So, I forgot where I was going with this. Oh, help! Thank you. Someone's here. What? Yeah. So Vasubandhu was criticizing the Mahayana. So in penance, you know, when you try to purify negative karma, you apply the four opponent forces. You know, you regret, take refuge, generate bodhicitta, or at least take refuge. You vow not to do it again. One of them is called the power of the antidote. Sometimes you do something positive to counteract the negative karma that you've created. If you've stolen, for instance, later in trying to purify that, you might make generosity. So in in criticizing the Mahayana, he realized he had criticized the Buddha's teachings, because he realized that the Mahayana was actually the teaching of the Buddha. So he wrote this book, Abhidharma Kosha, as a remedy, to try to praise, to understand the Buddha's teachings. He didn't write about the Mahayana, he wrote about the Vaibhashika, about the Mahavaibhasha. And Abhidharma Kosha, Abhidharma is a word that means higher knowledge. Kosha is a word that means like storehouse, or also kosha. If you have a sword, if you take the sword out of its container, the container, what do we say in English? A sheath or something? What is it? Scabbard. So the word for that also in Sanskrit is kosha, or storehouse. So it's sort of like the storehouse of the Abhidharma, he wrote. It was mainly talking about the Vaibhashika tenets, which we're talking about here, but slightly from the Sautrantika point of view. The Sautrantika was the system above the Vaibhashika that criticized many, that criticized partless particles, that criticized other kinds of things. Like, so for instance, another assertion of the Vaibhashika was that, oh no, I'll just leave it there. Yeah. So, in the Abhidharma Kosha, many of the sentences that were relating, that were talking about the Vaibhashika point of view, but Vasubandhu wanted to indicate to the reader was that was not actually right, because he was writing this from the point of view of the Sautrantikas. He would end the sentence with a certain particle, grammatical particle in Sanskrit, which would kind of meant like, so they say. Yeah. In Tibetan, I can't remember what the Sanskrit particle was. In Tibetan, it would end in lo, L-O. La, 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 naro, lo. Generally, that particle would not be at the end of a sentence unless you were calling the sentence into question. What would we do in English? We say, oh, yeah. Yeah. All men are really smart. Yeah, right. Or something like that. You know, you'd say something, maybe by your intonation or some word there. So he kind of left little tidbits in the Abhidharma Kosha that Vasubandhu was not agreeing with that. Okay. So I think that's a good start for today. I think we have, am I right, we have four classes of this? Only three? I think we have four. So we'll go through in the succeeding one, we'll talk a little bit about the Sautrantika after lunch. Next week we have one, because there's a puja, I think, maybe the week after that. Anyway, we'll try to go through these. Just a general introduction. So in conclusion, just before we go for a lunch break, anyone have any questions? Or yes, I can't see you back there. Is that Mabel? Yeah,
I'm Mabel. So the Vaibhashika standpoint that their ultimate truth is the smallest indivisible particle.
Not just that. Anything that's irreducible, such as partless moments of consciousness, things that are permanent, like cessations or uncompounded space. But that was one example. Partless particle was one. Partless moments of time, partless moments of consciousness, uncompounded space, things that were permanent.
I guess my question is, how do they know when it is the smallest particle? And if that smallest particle is their definition of ultimate truth, it's really up to the perceiver how small that particle is defined. So it's kind of like ultimate truth is shifting depending
kind of arbitrary,
on the perceiver.
Yeah, yeah. So because the other tenets also, even today we can divide things in the laboratory much finer with cyclotron beam or something, or you know, different things. We can divide things up much smaller particles than they could with a hammer in that time. I don't know what else, you know, in ancient India 500 years before Christ, you know, when the Buddha was there 600 years before, how fine particles. But they hypothesize, and maybe they took from some of the Buddha's teachings their interpretation of what the Buddha had said. They interpreted that there was some ultimate small particles, ultimate in that sense that they were ultimate truths, in the sense that they were irreducible. You couldn't get any smaller than that. Whereas things that were aggregation of those smallest particles of matter or of mind or of time, aggregation of those were conventional truths. Okay, but ultimate truths were, it wasn't as though that they could actually, they didn't have, I don't think they had lenses at that time. What was it, much later that people developed lenses to have microscopes and things to see smaller and smaller. So this was just an assumption on their part. In fact, was it a correct assumption? No, it was a wrong consciousness. It wasn't a right. The assumption, presumption, remember, of the seven ways of knowing, we say, or correct belief, meant that what you were believing was actually the case. This was a belief of theirs which was wrong from our point of view. Okay. Anyone else have a comment? Yes.
If I remember correctly, Basu Bandhu, the Ami Dharma Ghosha, mentioned that the water, though, is not...
He mentioned what?
The water.
Water?
That though is not breakable, is still conventional truth. If I remember correctly.
Say water again?
Though it cannot be broken, right? Water cannot be broken, cannot be broken.
Oh no! I think generally in the Vaibhashika system, which Vasubandhu was explaining in the Abhidharma Kosha, I think water is understood to be composed of atoms.
Yeah.
And those atoms themselves, there's a whole elaborate system. There were various atoms of the physical objects. Remember, we said that objects of sight were shape and color. And according to Vaibhashika, there were actually atoms of shape and color that were comprised of atoms of the four elements. You know, the four elements? Fire, air, what? Water, and earth. Right? So even water itself, the atoms of it, and the objects of sight also had another atom. Objects of sound that were, say, sounds, were comprised of these four atoms in different combinations of the fundamental elements, plus another atom of sound. And smell and taste and so forth all had, accumulations, aggregations of these four fundamental atoms of the four elements, plus some other atoms that were exclusive to that sense power. So even water atoms, they said, because they understood that water was comprised of atoms, those water atoms were comprised of these fundamental atoms of the four elements and also, it also had water atoms also had atoms of touch, because you can touch water and you have a tactile sensation. There were atoms of taste, because if you taste water, there's some taste. There were atoms of visual form within water, because you could actually see water. And say, for instance, there was, even though you might think water was mainly comprised of the water element, it still had atoms of, of earth atoms in it, because you could float. You could float on water. So it had some ability to support, like the earth element. So all phenomena, according to the Vaibhashika, were comprised of these atoms. And those atoms themselves, say the atom of water, could be broken up into these other constituent atoms. They themselves, at a certain point, you would reach something irreducible, some partless particle. So I'm not sure. If you can find the quotation where you said you couldn't break up water, I'd be interested to see. We'll see in what context that is. Okay. So we're going to take a break for lunch till 1:30. Good thinking, good comments, observations. Let's we'll make a more thorough dedication at the end, but just try to think, wow, we created some karma chewing on these dry bones this morning, some virtuous karma, analyzing the Buddhist teachings, leaving imprints in our mind as we hear, teachings later, that refer back to these things will be able to understand these subjects in context to eventually understand emptiness, to develop bodhicitta, renunciation. Due to these merits that I've created this morning, may they become the cause of my continued spiritual development up to and including enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings.